Hey there, Jeep Divers. Ready to unpack some serious history? Today we're diving deep into a single source, the book Essays in Modern World History, 1914-1989. 25 Key Questions Answered by Russell Tarr. Now I know what you're thinking, one book. But trust me, this isn't your average textbook, Russell Tarr seasoned history and politics teacher. And the mastermind behind activehistory.co.uk and classtools.net has crafted 25 standalone essays, each tackling a pivotal question from the 20th century. It's a brilliant format, really. You get these laser-focused insights into major events and figures.
Yeah.
Perfect for satisfying your curiosity or prepping for, say, that big history buff meeting.
Exactly. And we're not just summarizing. Oh, no. We're pulling out those did-you-know moments.
Yeah.
The historical curveballs that'll have you rethinking everything you thought you knew. For example, did you know that Lenin... Yes, that Lenin might not have had the peasant support everyone assumes, or that the Korean War's ripples are still shaping U.S. foreign policy today. Get ready for some serious aha moments.
What I find fascinating is how Tarr takes these monumental figures and events and reveals the unexpected nuances, the human stories behind the history. It's not just dates and battles, but understanding the choices people made and the often surprising consequences of those choices.
Okay, so buckle up, deep divers, because we're starting with a bang. Essay number one, was the Bolshevik Revolution the will of the people or Lenin's perfectly timed power grab? Tarr argues it might be more of the latter, which I found totally surprising.
It really challenges the traditional narrative, doesn't it? Tarr highlights how Lenin never truly won over the peasantry, a pretty significant portion of the Russian population at the time. This puts a whole new spin on things, suggesting his later brutality, like the Red Terror, wasn't just about communist ideals, but about holding onto power by any means necessary.
That's the thing about history. The more you dig, the messier it gets. And Tarr gives this great example, the Milyukov telegram incident. The new provisional government promises peace without annexations. Sounds good.
Right. Yeah. But then this telegram surfaces, revealing they were secretly promising land to their allies. Talk about a credibility killer.
Yeah.
It was the perfect opening for Lenin to seize the moment, capitalizing on the government's broken promises.
It makes you wonder, how often do we romanticize revolutions, assuming they're these neat and tidy uprisings of the people? The reality is often way more complicated.
It reminds me of that saying, one man's revolutionary is another man's tyrant. What we often see are power vacuums, and those who are most ruthless in filling them often determine the course of history.
It's a good thing to keep in mind, especially today, right? Now, Tarr doesn't stop there in Essay 3. He dives into Lenin's rule. And what's striking is that even his successes, according to Tarr, came at a steep cost.
Exactly. The Red Terror. The crushing of any opposition. Tarr argues these actions laid the groundwork for Stalin's later atrocities. It's a chilling example of how seemingly isolated events can have far-reaching consequences.
Like a domino effect. One brutal act setting the stage for another.
Okay, so let's shift gears to World War I. A truly global conflict that redefined the 20th century. Tarr poses a fascinating question in Essay 2. Was Germany's defeat inevitable? I mean, we know the outcome, but was it ever really in doubt? It's easy to look back and see the Allied victory as a foregone conclusion. But Tarr digs deeper. He points out that while Germany was undoubtedly outmatched in resources, they also made some crucial early blunders, like the Schlieffen Plan.
For those of us who need a refresher, what exactly was the Schlieffen Plan?
Imagine this. Germany, stuck between France in the west and Russia in the east, decides to launch a lightning-fast attack on France, hoping to knock them out of the war before Russia can even mobilize the problem. It relied on a lot of assumptions, like Belgium not resisting their invasion. And, well, things didn't exactly go according to plan.
And to make matters worse, Tarr highlights how Germany's harsh treatment of Russia in the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk totally backfired.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Instead of securing a quick peace and focusing on the Western Front, it actually strengthened the Allies' resolve. They saw what Germany was willing to do to a defeated foe and realized they had to fight tooth and nail to avoid the same fate.
It's like that old saying, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Except in this case, it was more like, the brutality shown to my enemy terrifies me into fighting even harder.
It's a stark reminder that even in the midst of war, actions have unforeseen consequences. Sometimes the opposite of what was intended. It's like putting out a fire with gasoline. Yeah. Sometimes the toughest actions just make things worse.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. So Germany's defeat wasn't inevitable then. It sounds like it was a combination of factors, resources, but also their own actions that kind of backfired.
Yeah.
Now, in Essay 4, Tarr dives into World War I's impact on Britain. And this is where it gets really interesting. We always hear about the immediate costs of war, the casualties, the destruction. But what about the long-term consequences, the stuff that isn't always so obvious?
And that's what makes Tarr's work so insightful. He gets into these long-term trends. He argues that World War I really marked the beginning of Britain's decline as a global superpower, you know?
Mm.
The war drained their resources. They lost their financial dominance to a rising United States.
So it shifted the whole balance of power.
Exactly. It's like the whole world order got rearranged.
Yeah, fascinating.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's switch gears for a bit and talk about something I've always found intriguing. Dictators. How do they stay in power for decades? We're talking Franco's Spain here, a regime that lasted almost 40 years. How is that even possible?
It's a question with some uncomfortable parallels to today's world, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Tarr's essay on Franco, essay 21, I think it was, it offers a really interesting case study.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to think of dictators as relying solely on brutality and repression. And while it was definitely part of Franco's playbook, it's not the whole story.
Right, because then there's the Spanish miracle, this period of huge economic growth under Franco. You wouldn't exactly expect that from a dictator.
It's one of those strange twists history throws at us. Tarr points out that Franco, despite his initial hardline approach, he eventually embraced economic liberalization. To some extent, anyway. It seems he realized that to stay in power, he needed to deliver at least some level of prosperity.
So it was a trade-off. Maintain control by giving up some economic control. Did it work? I mean, did Franco manage to hold on to power without sacrificing his grip completely?
That's the big question, right? And Tarr argues that Franco's methods definitely came at a cost. He essentially traded social and cultural freedoms for economic stability and to secure his own power.
A devil's bargain if there ever was one. It makes you think, though, about the compromises we make even in democracies, even today, right? I mean, when does progress go too far? When does it come at the expense of our values?
It's a question we should be asking ourselves constantly.
Mm.
And to fully grasp how Franco even gained that level of power, we have to go back to the Spanish Civil War, which Tarr covers in Essay 6, I believe.
Yeah.
The war wasn't just a simple left versus right battle. It exposed these deep societal rifts that stemmed from Spain's decline on the world stage.
So Franco was a master of exploiting those divisions then, using fear and resentment to his advantage.
Exactly. He understood how to leverage those existing tensions to consolidate his power, which is a good reminder that dictators don't just appear out of nowhere. They rise to power in times of chaos and division.
It's about exploiting those weaknesses,
yeah. Right?
Okay, let's move on to a topic I think most of our listeners are familiar with, at least on a basic level, the U.S. Civil Rights Movement. Now, Tarr highlights something really important that happened after 1964, a pivotal shift towards radicalization.
It's easy to think of this radicalization as a sudden break from the past. But as Tarr explains, it was a gradual process, a response to the painfully slow pace of change. Despite things like the Civil Rights Act, violence and discrimination persisted. And for many, it was a breaking point.
And Tarr includes this incredibly powerful quote from activist Stokely Carmichael, and it really gets at the heart of this frustration.
Mm.
He said, "A nonviolent approach to civil rights is an approach Black people cannot afford and a luxury white people do not deserve." It's raw, it's powerful, and it speaks volumes about the anger and disillusionment that fueled this new phase of the movement.
It's a reminder that patience has its limits, especially when it comes to fundamental human rights. And Tarr does a fantastic job of unpacking the different facets of this radicalization. The rise of groups like the Black Panthers, who believed in armed self-defense, a shift in focus from integration to Black power.
It's almost like they were saying, we're not asking to be let in anymore, we're building our own house.
Exactly. It became about self-determination, defining their own terms for liberation. And this shift, it wasn't just ideological. It had a geographic dimension too, as Tarr points out. There was a movement from the rural South to the urban North, reflecting a growing understanding that the fight for civil rights was deeply intertwined with economic justice.
It's about making those connections.
Right.
Recognizing that systemic racism, it wasn't just a Southern problem, it was an American problem. And this idea makes you think about the social justice movements of today, how the fight for equality, it's constantly evolving, adapting to the times.
It's true. History might not repeat itself, but it definitely rhymes. Yeah. The struggles of the past, they resonate in the present. It reminds us that the pursuit of justice, it never ends.
So true. Speaking of challenging the status quo, let's turn our attention to another leader who left an undeniable mark on the 20th century. Mao Zedong, his rise to absolute power in China. It's a chilling reminder of what happens when ambition goes unchecked.
And in Essay 23, Tarr really dissects how Mao achieved this absolute control, drawing comparisons to other dictators like Stalin, but also highlighting the differences. What I found striking was how Tarr emphasizes Mao's early pragmatism, his focus on building popular support.
That's not exactly the image that comes to mind when you think of Mao.
Right, and yet, in his early years, he understood how crucial it was to appeal to the masses, even while he was ruthlessly eliminating his opponents. But as Tor points out, this pragmatism eventually gave way to dangerous rigidity, especially during the Great Leap Forward.
Yes, the Great Leap Forward. A textbook example of a misnomer, if there ever was one. Tor tells this almost unbelievable story about backyard furnaces, where millions of peasants were forced to melt down anything metal, even tools, just to try and meet these impossible production goals. It's hard to imagine the level of delusion, the sheer human suffering that must have gone on.
It's a perfect example of how ideology, when taken to extremes, can have absolutely devastating consequences. Tor argues that this period, it exposed the fatal flaw in Mao's model. He might have consolidated power, but at a tremendous cost, leaving China reeling from famine and social unrest.
It's a sobering thought that leadership based solely on ideology, it's a recipe for disaster, real progress. It requires a balance, vision and pragmatism, a willingness to adapt and to prioritize the well-being of the people above all else.
A good reminder that ideology isn't a substitute for competence. And speaking of leaders with complicated legacies, Tor's essay on Richard Nixon, Essay 24, I think, really highlights how difficult it is to categorize these historical figures.
Yep.
I mean, this is the guy who opened relations with China, a communist nation.
Yeah.
And yet he was also caught up in scandals like Watergate. It's hard to reconcile those two things.
Talk about a mixed bag.
Yeah.
Right. Nixon is full of these contradictions. So how does Tor make sense of it all?
Well, he argues that a lot of Nixon's foreign policy, especially his pursuit of detente with China and the USSR, it came down to pragmatism. He wanted to end the Vietnam War and counterbalance the Soviet Union, even if it meant working with communist regimes.
Which seems kind of counterintuitive for a staunch anti-communist like Nixon. But then you have things like the Chennault Affair, where Nixon supposedly sabotaged peace talks during the Vietnam War just to boost his own chances of becoming president. It's hard to square that with this idea of him as a pragmatist.
It really does make you question his motivations. And Tor doesn't shy away from these contradictions. He presents them as evidence of Nixon's complex and often morally ambiguous nature.
It's a good reminder that history and the people who shape it are rarely black and white. More often than not, we're dealing with shades of gray.
Absolutely. And those shades of gray, they make it difficult to judge these figures from the past with any kind of certainty. Do we focus on their accomplishments, their failures, the intentions behind their actions? It's a question historians continue to grapple with.
And a question worth considering as we engage with history, right? It's not about passing judgment. It's about trying to understand these figures in all their complexity. So as we wrap up our deep dive into Russell Tor's essays in modern world history, what are some of the key takeaways? What are we left grappling with?
For me, it's the enduring impact of ideology. We've seen how ideologies like communism, fascism, black nationalism, how they've shaped entire nations, sparked revolutions, led to incredible progress on one hand, and unimaginable suffering on the other.
It's like this double-edged sword.
Right.
Ideas can be incredibly powerful tools for good or for evil. And I think that's what makes studying history so important. It's a reminder that we have a responsibility to be critical thinkers, to question the narratives we're given, to think about the consequences of our beliefs.
It's about learning from the past, both the triumphs and the tragedies, to create a better future. So if history is any guide, what lessons from the 20th century are most crucial for us to heed in the 21st? That's something I think we all need to ask ourselves.
That's a fantastic point to end on. It's not just about understanding the past. It's about using that understanding to navigate the present and the future. We hope this deep dive has sparked your curiosity, challenged your assumptions, and given you a fresh perspective on the events that have shaped our world.
And we encourage everyone listening to check out Tor's book for yourselves. It's a thought-provoking read, full of insights that will deepen your understanding of history and challenge you to think critically about the world around you.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep learning.